Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to filter the noise and bring you the key insights from across the web.
That's right. And today, Friday, April 18th, 2025, we're zoning in on Hacker News. It's always buzzing, so we pick out a few front page highlights.
Yeah, it's a real mix today. We've got Defold, this game engine.
Mm-hmm. And a crazy ShowHN project, a Doom-like game in a QR code. Seriously?
Yeah, okay, that sounds wild. Then there's a pretty significant court ruling about cell tower data.
Yep, constitutional stuff. Plus, a big security upgrade for Python's cryptography.
And wrapping up with some C++ performance tips, or maybe controversies, from a repo called Less Slow C++F.
It promises a lot, let's put it that way. So yeah, a packed agenda. We'll try to pull out the surprising bits and what really matters from each.
All right, let's jump in. First up, Defold. What's the story here? It's billed as a free, source-available game engine.
Yeah, exactly. The big draw seems to be performance and true cross-platform capability. They list, everything. PlayStation 5, 4, Switch, Android, iOS, macOS, Linux, Windows, Steam, HTML5.
Wow, okay. So pretty much anywhere you'd want to release a game.
Right. And they're even mentioning upcoming Xbox support. They really emphasize this no setup idea too. Mm-hmm. Integrated visual editor, code editor, using Lua, debugging tools, all built in.
Lua scripting, interesting. And no setup is always appealing, makes it sound very approachable.
That seems to be the goal. They also have this zero config cloud build system. So you write your game, push a button, and it theoretically builds native versions for all those platforms.
That simplifies things a lot. What about customization, though, if you need more control?
They seem to cover that, too. There's an asset portal for plugins and extensions. You can set up local builds if you want. And crucially, you can write native code extensions. So if Lua isn't cutting it for a specific part, you can drop down to native code, plus integrations with common tools.
Okay, so it's flexible now, that free forever promise.
Yeah.
How does that work? That's always the tricky part with free software, right? Sustainability.
Well, that ties into the source available license, which sparks quite a bit of discussion on Hacker News. It's not strictly open source, like, say, GPL. The engine code is available.
But there's always a but.
But the license restricts you from commercializing forks of the engine itself. You can absolutely make and sell games using Defold, royalty-free, fee-free. You can even make proprietary modifications to the engine for your own game and not release them.
Okay. So they protect the core engine platform from direct commercial competition using their own code, but let game developers run wild.
That's the idea. And someone on HN actually praised them for being clear and using source available instead of trying to muddy the waters by calling it open source when it has that key restriction.
That's fair. Transparency is good. Did the HN discussion bring up any other interesting points?
Yeah, a few things. People noted the WASMM support, which is great for web games. Its history. It originally came from King, the Candy Crush people. So it has a solid pedigree before being spun out to the Defold Foundation.
Right. So it's not just some hobby project.
Definitely not. There's also optional static typing for Lua using something called Teal and even experimental C# support, though its main strength seems to be 2D mobile and web games.
And one last quirky detail.
Oh, yeah. The GUI editor itself is apparently built in Clojure, which is unusual for game dev tools.
Huh. Okay, so Defold, powerful, genuinely cross-platform, free for game makers, but with a specific source available license to keep the engine itself non-commercialized by others. Interesting model.
Definitely one to watch.
All right, next up is that QR code game you mentioned, ShowHN. I made a Doom-like game fit inside a QR code. How?
Right. It's called the Back Dooms. It's inspired by Doom, obviously, and also that internet phenomenon, the back rooms.
Mm.
And yeah, the entire thing, code, assets, everything is compressed down to fit into the data payload of a single QR code.
So you scan it and you get her run and you can just link somewhere.
Nope. If your mobile browser supports the right features, they mention decompression stream APIs, which Edge, Yandex, and Opera apparently do it. Unpacks and runs the game right there in the browser. It's a self-contained, self-extracting HTML game.
That is incredibly clever. What was the point, though? Just a cool tech demo?
Pretty much. The creator described it as pushing the limits of QR code storage and compression, kind of exploring it as a novel way to distribute tiny web apps.
Okay, you got to give us the technical breakdown. How do you squish a game, even a simple one, into that tiny space?
Well, it's a multi-step process. First, extreme compression on the initial HTML, likely using zlib or something similar.
Okay, zip it up tight.
Then, encode that compressed data using Base64. That turns the binary data into text characters, so you can embed it safely within HTML source code.
Got it. Like embedding an image directly in an email sometimes.
Sort of, yeah. Then you need a small piece of JavaScript code embedded in the HTML. This is the self-extracting part. When the page loads, that script grabs the Base64 encoded game data, decodes it, and uses the browser's decompression stream to unzip it back into the playable game.
And the browser just runs it.
Yep. The final step is taking that entire HTML file, the JavaScript extractor, and the Base64 game data, and turning it into what's called a data URI. It's basically one massive text string that represents the whole file. That string is what gets encoded into the QR code pattern.
Wow. And generating the QR code itself must have been tricky, fitting that whole string in.
For sure. They'd have aimed for the smallest QR version possible that could hold the data, probably using the lowest error correction level to maximize space. And it's all MIT licensed, so you can go look at the source if you're curious.
That's seriously impressive. A game delivered by QR scan. Mind blown.
Okay, shifting gears dramatically now. This legal ruling about cell tower data. Sounds important. It really is. This happened in Nevada, a federal case called United States v. Spurlock. A judge ruled that these massive blanket searches of cell tower location data are unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment.
Blanket searches? What does that mean in this context, collecting everyone's data from a tower?
Essentially, yes. It refers to law enforcement getting records for all phones that connected to specific cell towers over a certain period, often before they even have a specific suspect. It's casting a super wide net.
And the judge said that violates the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable searches.
Exactly. The ruling emphasized the need for searches to be specific, narrowly tailored to a particular crime or suspect. Collecting data on potentially thousands of innocent people just wasn't specific enough.
The Hacker News discussion must have picked up on the privacy angle.
Oh, absolutely. Lots of comments about how this kind of thing scoops up data on countless people completely unrelated to any investigation. There were also mentions of how similar techniques, like cell tower dumps or geofence warrants, were used in things like the January 6th investigation.
Is this ruling related to the whole third-party doctrine thing, where data held by companies might have less protection?
It touches on it. The third-party doctrine is this idea that information you voluntarily share with a third party, like your phone company, might not get full Fourth Amendment protection. But rulings like this, and the earlier Supreme Court Carpenter decision about cell location history, are chipping away at that doctrine, recognizing the sensitivity of location data.
Right. Now, someone on HM brought up the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine. Can you explain that quickly?
Sure. It basically means if police get evidence illegally, that's the poisonous tree, then any other evidence they find, because of that illegal discovery, the fruit might also be inadmissible in court.
And was there debate about applying it here? Because the police did get a warrant initially, right? Even if it was later found unconstitutional.
Exactly. That's the complexity. There's often a good faith exception. If police acted reasonably based on a warrant they believed was valid at the time, the evidence might still be allowed, even if the warrant is later invalidated. The counterargument is that excluding the evidence is the only real way to incentivize police to ensure their methods are constitutional going forward.
So this ruling specifically targets these broad blanket searches. Does it affect more targeted tracking, like geofencing for a specific crime location?
That's a key distinction. The ruling seems focused on the lack of specificity in these blanket requests. More targeted geofence warrants, aimed at a specific location and time relevant to a known crime, might still pass constitutional muster, though they are also subject to legal challenges.
And what about stingrays, those fake cell towers police use?
That's a really good question raised in the discussion. Since stingrays also collect data broadly from devices in an area, this ruling could potentially strengthen arguments against their warrantless use. It's definitely an area to watch.
Okay, fascinating stuff with major privacy implications. Let's switch back to code. Python getting a big cryptography upgrade. 15,000 lines of verified code.
Yeah, this is a pretty big deal for Python's security posture. Jonathan Prusenko from Microsoft Research wrote about it. Essentially, all the standard hash algorithms like SHA-256, SHA-3, Blake-2, and the HMAC functions that Python provides out of the box are now implemented using code from HACL.
And HACL is special because it's formally verified. What does that actually mean?
It means the code hasn't just been tested. It's been mathematically proven to be correct according to its specification. Using advanced software tools based on formal methods, they can build high assurance that the crypto algorithms are implemented without the kind of subtle bugs that can lead to security vulnerabilities.
So much higher confidence that the crypto is actually doing what it's supposed to securely.
Exactly. And the best part for Python developers is that this transition was apparently transparent. You just use hashlib or hmac like always. You don't need to change your code. Python now just vendors these 15,000 lines of verified C code from HACL under the hood.
That's pretty seamless. Did HACL have to add anything new to work with Python?
Yes, quite a bit. Python had specific needs. They needed extra modes for the Blake 2 hash, a new unified API for all the SHA-3 KEKAK variants, better ways to handle potential memory allocation failures, and crucially, streaming APIs, especially for HMAC.
Streaming APIs. Why are those important for crypto?
Well, think about hashing a huge file. You don't want to load the whole thing into memory, right?
Mm-hmm.
Streaming APIs let you feed the data to the hash function piece by piece. It processes it incrementally. It's more efficient and necessary for large inputs, but it's also way harder to implement correctly and securely because the function has to maintain internal state between calls.
Right. Makes sense. And getting that wrong could be bad.
Very bad. In fact, the post mentions a CVE, a vulnerability, from 2022 in Python's old unverified SHA-3 implementation. That incident was apparently a big motivator for moving to HACL.
Okay, so the verification really matters. The article mentioned fully generic verification for streaming. Sounds complex.
It's a clever idea. Instead of verifying the streaming logic separately for SHA-256, then SHA-3, then Blake 2, they created a generic framework. They formally define the properties any secure block-based algorithm must have, using things like dependent types in the F language HACL is written in. Then they verify a single generic streaming construction that works securely with any algorithm fitting that definition.
So verify the pattern once, then apply it to specific algorithms.
Pretty much. It saves a huge amount of verification effort. But getting that generic pattern right was tough. They had to handle variable output sizes, algorithms needing pre-inputs, state management, all sorts of edge cases.
Sounds like a serious engineering challenge. Any tricky implementation details mentioned?
Yeah, there was a specific build issue with HMAC. HMAC uses an underlying hash function, like SHA-256. Sometimes those underlying functions have super optimized versions using processor instructions like AVX2. They had to figure out how to compile the generic HMAC code cleanly alongside these optional specialized AVX2 implementations. They used a C programming pattern, an abstract struct, to manage it.
And memory allocation. Always a potential pitfall.
Yep. They had to be really careful to ensure that if memory allocation failed anywhere inside the crypto functions, that failure would be reliably propagated back up so the calling Python code knows something went wrong. They used option types in F to represent success or failure, which translates to error checks in the generated C code.
It sounds like a massive undertaking, but a really valuable one for anyone relying on Python's built-in crypto.
Absolutely. It's a major boost in assurance for a fundamental part of the Python standard library.
Okay, last stop on our Hacker News tour. Less slow C++. A GitHub repo promising faster C++, 20, C, CUDA, even assembly code. What's this all about?
It's a collection of code examples and benchmarks by Ashfordanian, aiming to teach techniques for writing high-performance code across these languages. It covers a lot of numerics, IMD, coroutines, ranges, exceptions, networking, user space IO.
So a practical guide to speeding things up.
That's the idea. It throws out some pretty bold claims and questions like asking if you can make trigonometry 40 times faster or pointing out that sometimes just generating random input for a benchmark can take longer than the thing you're actually trying to measure. It uses various libraries for benchmarking too.
Okay, that 40x faster trigonometry sounds like clickbait. Did Hacker News call it out?
Oh, immediately.
Yeah.
That generated the most heat. The speedup comes from using a very simple polynomial approximation for SynX, basically just the first few terms of the Taylor series.
Which is fast, but not very accurate.
Exactly. Commenters piled on, pointing out that this approximation is only remotely accurate within a tiny range. The author later clarified it to miss it to 2, 2, and crucially, it completely omits range reduction.
Range reduction.
That's the step standard library syn functions do first. They take any input angle and mathematically reduce it to an equivalent angle within that small core range where the approximation works best. That reduction step has its own computational cost.
So the 40x claim ignored a vital part of the calculation and sacrificed accuracy.
Pretty much. It's comparing apples and oranges. People suggested that for real-world use, where you need decent accuracy and speed, you'd look at things like Chebyshev or Riemann's approximations, which offer much better trade-offs. It was a good reminder that performance claims always need context and scrutiny.
Definitely. Did the discussion touch on anything else from the repo?
Yeah, there was a good point about applicability. Someone working with microcontrollers noted that while the repo focuses heavily on throughput, getting calculations done fast in constrained embedded systems, things like code size and memory usage, especially stack usage, are often more critical.
So techniques that are great on a server might be terrible on a tiny chip.
Right. Some modern C++ features, like maybe compile time regular expressions, which the repo apparently benchmarks positively with CTRE, can be heavy on compile times or stack usage, making them less suitable for really small systems. It depends on your bottleneck.
Any other interesting nuggets?
Someone asked for content comparing FPGA coding to GPU coding. There was surprise at how well CTRE performed in the benchmarks, though acknowledgement that compiler differences matter. And a suggestion to look at libraries like Intel's Hyperscan if you need truly high-performance regex matching in production. Also, the author mentioned that current C++ asynchronous I/O with coroutines often still has too much runtime overhead for their taste.
So, less slow C++ may be a source of interesting ideas and benchmarks, but take the headline claims with a grain of salt and consider your specific context.
That sums it up well. It's about understanding the trade-offs between speed, accuracy, memory, and complexity for your specific problem and platform.
Well, that covers our Hacker News front page sweep for today. From game engines finding sustainable models like Dfold,
to the sheer technical fun of squeezing a game into a QR code,
through the serious constitutional questions around cell tower data privacy,
the quiet but vital improvements to Python's security foundations,
and the never-ending quest for performance in C++8, pitfalls and all.
It really shows the breadth of what captures attention in the tech world. Practical tools, legal battles, foundational security, clever hacks.
So the question for you listening is, what stands out? Is it the Dfold model for balancing free access and sustainability? Or maybe the implications of that cell tower ruling for other surveillance tech? Or perhaps just the sheer ingenuity of the Backdooms QR game?
Yeah, lots to chew on. As always, the links to the discussions and projects will be available if you want to dive deeper yourself. It's always worth reading the original conversations.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll be back to explore more insights soon.
Until then, keep exploring.